At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Warden's Watch Podcast is now on Patreon, combining the Thin Green Line Podcast and the Warden's Watch Podcast on Patreon to bring member-exclusive extra content, both video, audio, and with product deals as well. Become a member to support our podcast and get something extra. Search Warden's Watch Podcast on Patreon.
Welcome, guys, to the Thin Green Line Podcast. And today we have the privilege of having Bud Carr, search and rescue expert from the Pacific Northwest, joining us. And he's going to give us a lot of interesting perspectives, not only on a great background he's had, but some of the search and rescue cases related to arduous conditions, especially in that northwestern corner where we both live, up around Washington, Montana, Idaho, and also compare notes with how my brother Wayne Saunders and the search and rescue teams out east do it as well. Bud, how are you? And welcome to the show.
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, welcome,
really
Bud.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, before we get started, man, I got to give a shout out to your and my mutual friend, Luke Randall from Kodiak Life. I had no idea you were out there until Luke mentioned you. And as you know, and Wayne, as I think you know as well, because it's before recording, Luke is an outfitter and a guide up all over Kodiak and Afognak Island for brown bear and fishing trips, and spent his whole life up there and has been immersed in very arduous, dangerous conditions just to go recreate in that area. Right, Bud? So kudos to Luke, great guy. And I want to thank Luke for guiding you to us, or guiding me to you, or however we want to define that.
Right.
When I started looking into your background and you and I have dialogue, just blown away by some of the cases you guys have done. And I was unaware of them, but now we are. So thanks for being on the show, man. And tell us a little bit about how you got into this whole world of search and rescue, and how it all started.
Well, in the 80s, I was born in California. We moved around a lot. My dad was quite the entrepreneur growing up as a young man. In the 80s, he ended up acquiring a gold mine up in Colorado called the June July Basin Gold Mine. And he operated that for about a decade. And during that time, he was a search and rescue coordinator there within, was it Mesa County? I can't remember the county. And so, you know, back in the 80s growing up, it was, you know, I would be able to accompany my dad because he was a coordinator, and how they usually ran it was, you know, a hiker or a hunter or a gold miner went missing. You know, the call would go out to the whole community. Hey, we need people that are, you know, good mountain people to come out and help find the missing individual. And, you know, they go to the trailhead or wherever that was closest to the search zone. He had this huge, you know, military canvas tent, set that up, and people would start showing up. And those who were deemed, you know, capable of going out in the field without getting hurt or injured or lost, they'd let him go out in the field. And there was quite a few times that I'd be able to accompany my dad because, you know, he'd stay at the command center and that's where he'd coordinate from. So as a young kid, I could sit there and hang out with my dad. And also I was a Boy Scout. So that was part of doing some Boy Scout stuff too, to earn some merit badges. It wasn't until 2010 that I really got into, you know, search and rescue in the sense of what, how we are and what me and my team actually does. We're not with a separate entity or a separate organization. We're kind of our own organization. And we, me and a whole bunch of friends, we were just going up into the mountains to go spend like 4 days. And we stopped by the Rockport store, and the owner, Dave, saw us there, and he's like, "Hey, you guys know that there's a missing lady up on Sauk Mountain. I could stand in my backyard and see Sauk Mountain from my house." And it's right. Summit's 5,600 feet. We're like, "No, we didn't know that." He's like, "Yeah, she went missing last night. They're up there right now. You should go up there and lend a hand." Okay. So, me and my three friends, we went up there. One of them is a former 19 Delta Cavalry Scout that was based out of Fort Lewis McChord. That was such a tongue twister. So we go up there, command center set up. We go to ask, to offer our services and help. And we were rejected and turned away. And it was kind of disheartening, but they asked us, "Hey, we got this under control. Will you please leave?" So, we left. 3 days later, they called off the search. And, me and my friends, they didn't find her. So we decided to go back up there and look some more. And while we were doing that, we ended up bumping into the family came together, coordinated with them, and searched up there for about a month and a half. Some things were coming about, like her boyfriend she was with was really notorious, has a really bad criminal background, was facing federal criminal charges for gun running and all this other stuff. And the family started to believe, because she found out about some things that he was into, drugs, gun running, things like that. So the family was starting to collect evidence that, she might not have ever been on the mountain, that might have been a whole charade, and she could have met with foul play. And the son, Alan, of the woman, Patty Krieger was her name, asked us, was like, "Hey, I don't think my mom's on this mountain. Therefore, I don't want you guys out here risking your life and limbs for, my mom, who I don't even think's out here."
Right.
So we kind of, stopped. We stopped that. There was one time after that where the son, came to me and was like, "Hey, there's a rumor. There's this old limestone mine that's only like a mile and a half from my house that a lot of kids, used to frequent back in the 90s. I used to frequent it all the time. It's a pretty cool old mine. There's lots of shafts down in there and stuff." And well, there was a rumor that, he used to hang out there. So he thought maybe he took Patty there and might have pushed her down into a mine shaft. Mm. And the family reached out to search and rescue and law enforcement about it, but because of the danger that it was and the lack of like really good solid lead, it wasn't worth them going in there and investigating. So the family asked me and my team, "Hey, we really think that this could be a possibility. Would you be willing to go inside there and look?" And I was like, "Heck yeah." I've done, I'm a mountaineer. I know how to work ropes. I've done some spelunking in my day as a Boy Scout in Utah. There was great caves in Utah to go spelunk in. So we went down in there, and fortunately or unfortunately, she wasn't in there, and she still remains missing to this day.
Wow. But it sounds like that case and how convoluted and just mysterious and sinister that got, it kind of generated an interest from that point to work those type of cases where you guys could you could adjunct a formalized search and rescue team through the county, through the sheriff's office, through allied agencies like Wayne and I have always worked on. Usually, our search and rescue teams are comprised of people from multiple agencies.
Yeah.
So fast forward us to some of the stuff you did after that and how you integrated with those teams and some of the finds that you were successful on. Cause you just sent us an article that was really interesting on a case that had been going on several years. And it looks like there's a couple interesting new cases coming up that you and your team will be adjuncting formalized teams or, government teams, if you will, to try to solve the case and try to either save a life or get some closure for some family members that have had a missing person out there for way too long and they've just gone undetected.
So that's our main focus with my team is strictly on the missing who's been out there presumed dead for quite some time.
Okay.
You know, the West Coast has the best and the best search and rescue teams out here is on the West Coast. And that was something we kind of talked about before we started recording, between the difference between the East Coast and the West Coast. You know, the funding out here, I don't know if it's a lot of it has to do with the terrain, you know, the mountains. We got all the big box outdoor stores here, you know, REI's headquarters. Right. You know, we have all the volcanoes up the West Coast. You could go from the oceans to rugged mountains like the Alps in an hour drive. So up here, they are really highly outfitted, trained, experienced, and skilled. And, you know, if they don't find you within the first 48 hours up to, I would say, you know, maybe 72, chances are them finding you is going to be slim to none. It's just the statistics of it, unfortunately, and more than likely that you're perished. And lost person behavior, as you guys know, being in search and rescue, people who vanish without a trace is in that 3% percentile range that you got a 3% chance of ever finding those people. So we come in after search and rescue has done everything that they have done. Sometimes, you know, they'll work with us, giving us, you know, the case file, all the detailed maps of where, you know, they have worked and have searched, the copies of reports. And then, you know, and then from there, because they only have so many resources, and search and rescue, you know, the resources are to bring people home alive.
Right.
And I hope that at some, you know, at some point in time, we can create, I don't know, some type of fund with cold case search and rescue teams who do continue to go out and have the resources they need to continue on a case to find them. Because, you know, the person is gone, but they leave a whole family of people behind who still care and still don't know what happened to their loved one. And, you know, the not knowing has got to be the worst.
Yeah, it brings up a really good point that you don't really think of, and the public doesn't think of it. And even us coming from agency backgrounds and operational there, you know, you don't really focus on that second phase of the lost hiker, the missing person, you know, in arduous terrain that just completely disappears. They don't get found. And then, you know, there's so much crazy other stuff in the news, obviously, with where we're at right now. Everything is blowing up, and that story is going to just go away really quickly. And to even know that there's teams like yours out there that will take a cold case file and put some time and effort to try to, you know, find that person is really huge. And, you know, something we promote on the Thin Green Line is how precious and necessary our outdoor environment is for mental health, for water purity, for wildlife species. And we know it's being impacted all the time and threatened all the time throughout the entire country. And we want to encourage people to be out there to help protect it, to help enjoy it, right?
Right.
But, you know, conversely, if you're going to go out there untrained or unprepared, and all three of us in this conversation know that, we can get into some real trouble and we can end up, you know, injured or worse. And, you know, it can kind of put a fear into non-outdoor type people coming from urban environments that are trying to get into conservation, ethical, legal hunting, trying to explore rivers, trying to fish for the first time, or just go backpacking or hiking. And then something like this happens and, you know, it can terrify people and it can alienate people if you really look at it deeply. And then not to have closure from a lost loved one. I mean, that would put the fear of, you know what, in anybody, of even going back into that particular area where somebody was lost. So
yeah,
it's super cool that you guys are doing that and that you have the support of at least the agencies in the Northwest, it sounds like. And I worked with similar groups in California a little bit, because again, a lot of search and rescue teams, highly trained, you know, a lot of allied agency support when we come together. But there were cases, and Wayne can tell some stories too, where we didn't find the missing person.
Yeah.
You know, and to this day, they still haven't been found. And in a lot of cases, getting into, you know, the cartel cannabis issue of the Hidden War issue that we talk about quite a bit on this podcast and on Warden's Watch, some of it can be related to that. We know it's related to that. They stumble on the road, they stumble into a cartel criminal that can't have that thing discovered because LE hasn't been on it yet. And we know people disappear because of that, but a multitude of other reasons. So just being able to find and close that is huge. certainly curious what stories you have of anybody you have found, or what cases you're looking to go after that are the most, I don't know, craziest, if you will, or most sinister.
Yeah. Before you go into that, though, but I'd like to just, you know, before we move on that conversation, I got to disagree with you that the best search and rescue teams are on the West Coast. But having been a search manager on the East Coast, I can say I don't have experience with West Coast, but I certainly know my East Coast teams are very top notch. And without those, especially the volunteers, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. And being that search manager that turns groups of people that want to join away, because, A, we haven't vetted them, we don't know their experience. Yeah. And it sounds like, and that just like our groups have increased as, you know, you say no, and they, well, why? Well, this, and they go get organized, and then they come back and we vet them, and then they become such a resource. And it sounds like you have done that. So kudos to you.
Well,
for
to
doing
a certain
extent. Okay.
I wasn't meaning to disparage against the East Coast SAR teams out there, but from what I've heard as far as in the SAR community, that's a little ego battle between the East Coast versus the West Coast.
And I'll give you that.
You know, who wants to be the king of the mountain, I guess. And out here they want to say, oh, well, we got the biggest mountains, so we must be
you
the
do.
Kings. I don't know. But I try to stay out of that as much as possible when it comes to that.
Yeah. Certainly resources are huge.
You know, I don't want to mislead anybody, you know, with my organization and my team. You know, we do get a lot of resistance from many of the search and rescue organizations out here because of what we do. And the biggest reason why is because of how we do it. One, you know, we're very public about our missions. Mm-hmm. We work hand in hand with the family. And you know, the biggest thing that they really don't like about us is the fact that we're public with our missions. You know, we video record with our GoPros out there. We have updates on our search missions out there, and because search and rescue don't operate that way, you know, they don't like to be public about the right. fine details, the daily details of what transpires out there. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we do it is one, because the cases that we're on, you know, it gives the daily solace to these families that they can literally see there's somebody out there searching for my loved one. Mm-hmm. You know, that gives them a solace every day to be able to actually see it. Because sure, I could say, yeah, we're out there looking and I'm sitting on my couch, you know. So that's the number one reason why we are very public and have a social media presence with our search operations is because the families really do love having that mm-hmm. for them.
Totally.
Well, and to your point there, Bud, and Wayne, you and I have experienced this a lot. There's always that rift when, you know, organized law enforcement, search and rescue, governmental run teams, and you come up to what are basically civilian contractors with a ton of experience. And there's always going to be that rift. And I'm going to put an example that's relevant to the conversation. We have contractor security teams actually in the Emerald Triangle of California and all over California on private tracts of big timberland that are covered with cartel, you know, cannabis grows. Mm-hmm. And the sheriff's office or us from Fish and Wildlife Met or our cannabis enforcement teams will work those areas, but we're so overwhelmed on the public land stuff just because of sheer numbers that these contractor groups that are hired by those landowners of private tracts, highly skilled, very proficient, know exactly what to do from the standpoint of their certifications to what level of detainment they can do before they call in the sheriff's office or they call in, you know, fish and game wardens or whatever the case may be. But a lot of those teams, you know, just don't get a lot of love from the agencies because they aren't inside the law enforcement umbrella. And quite honestly, after working with a couple of cool teams, specifically Lear and Paul Truett's team out in Northern California, it's unjustified that we don't let them in more. It's something that we're always low on numbers. We're always stressed to the max because especially in the game warden world, Wayne and I mean, yeah, you know, we're like the Kenny shoe salesman of like every shoe, right? You got to like do every job on the traditional side. And then we're doing search teams. And then we're doing special operations with cannabis work like our Met unit. Yeah. And I was a little apprehensive when I started to first meet these contractor groups, but then getting to work with them and having them get that vettedness from us and being such an assisting aid and a force multiplier and have an area knowledge that we don't even have because they're so intimate with the area that they're on a contract to protect, to patrol, or whatever the case may be. It's awesome. So
yeah,
as long as you establish your credibility, that they're not a bunch of rogue cowboys out there, that these guys are really skilled. They know what they're doing. We don't have a liability from agency for what they're going to do. So maybe we can share the wealth a little bit and they can go a little bit outside the box than we can, because we got to get back to our day job. We have those protocols and then we can continue doing it. And I think it's a great thing when done correctly, having had that experience. But you are the first, contractor, quote unquote, civilian, search and rescue team coming in to do something like that, that I've ever got to talk to. So it's really interesting for, and Wayne having his search and rescue background, I can't speak for him, but I don't think he's run across a group like yours either. No. I could be wrong, Wayne, but fill us in. So it's kind of cool to see how we can help each other and get the word out that with a good vetted team in this world, just like I say, with private land contracting protection against cartel gunmen, I think it's a great asset when done correctly.
Correct. Yeah, totally. We're not just a bunch of hillbillies that say, let's grab some bush beer and head to the mountains,
Let's go. Yeah, let's go dive in a cave and start spelunking.
Right.
Yeah. You're a resource after the fact, though, but that's the cold case. When you coined it that way, that brings it into very good perspective. And there's not a lot of teams out there. New England Canine is one of them that will go out months and months and months after and continue to look. But there isn't a lot of resources out there for families to go to when I have to break the news that we're going to break off the search and rescue mission, because you're right, that the odds of life existing after 3 and 4 days of this weather are probably pretty rare. That, so cold case, I don't even want to call it search and rescue, man.
No. We try not to use that term either.
Right.
We're not really rescuing anybody alive, but we, in a sense, are rescuing, the person off the mountain in that sense. And we're rescuing the families. And that's the biggest thing is, the bonds and a lot of people ask me, why don't you just become search and rescue? Why don't you become search and rescue, right? And just join the search and rescue team. Well, the number one is I like being able to operate how I like to operate. Mm-hmm. Up here in the West Coast, up here, search and rescue, the only teams who could stay out overnight is the Hasty team. Mm-hmm. And that's when someone's life is completely on the line and they have the best of the best in their team go out and search all night, stay on the mountain, stay in the field and keep at it until they're finally withdrawn. Right. Me, I like being able, I hate wasting time running up and down the trail or driving up and down from my house to the trailhead. It's so much time and energy that people waste to get to the search zone. Whereas us, even though we know that the people are 90-some% chance that they are perished, I still want to just be able to go up, set up a forward operating base right there in the search zone and stay there and just work from there. Spend all my time and energy actually searching and not getting to and from the search.
Yeah. No, that makes great sense. Do you use canines? I look at the skills that you're looking for. I mean, bird activity, animal activity. I mean, there's all kinds of things that come to my mind doing what you do. And like I said, there's very few people out there doing it. So I would say don't join a search and rescue. Do keep doing what you're doing, because it is rare. And what a great thing for the family connection to have somebody out there updating them. And, most state agencies don't like social media. It's hard to break that. But having you guys out there, I can see where the sense. I was big on, I was the guy that was always breaking the news to the family during the search and rescue. That was my skill set. It was horrible. But I made an effort to update them as much as I could, what we were doing, as much detail as I could, no matter what, because it's critical to have that connection. And you're extending that on. And yeah, there's some comfort that somebody's out there still looking for their loved ones, and I'm sure they're updating you as much as they can, things like that. But the skill sets that you bring, and I mean, and do I agree with the traveling back and forth. I've had to make some calls leaving teams out when I know it's miserable, it's snowy, it's wet, and but you know, by the time they hike out, we hike back in, they're there. Guys, hunker down, deploy, and it's a tough call to make, but you are 100% right. You're there, and it sounds like you really envelop into that search area and really take it in and become part of it.
Yes. If they're out there laying on the ground alone, the least I can do is be out there laying on the ground alone also. And my team. It also shows the families the level of sincerity of us, because that's who we are really bringing the greatest benefit to is the families. Mm-hmm. There's people out here who go missing and I've got friends that we've talked about it. Hey, if I ever go missing, it's two things. It's either I'm gone forever and I died in a place where I wanted to be, or two, I'll show back up in 3 or 4 weeks haggard. Some of these people that go missing, that's where they wanted to go missing. That's the place where they wanted to have their final moment was out there in God's graces. But it's the families who are left behind who are the ones that are suffering. The missing person is, like I said, probably already gone. In another plane of existence, but the families are still here suffering on this existence. And that's who we're really bringing the greatest benefit to is to them.
Mm. Yeah. And kudos that you guys are doing that. And I think, to Wayne's point, that's the difference between an organized agency response of what we can and can't share. And obviously, Wayne, you said it best when from the standpoint of social media and telling the story and bringing back a story that's critical of a missing person, that we've moved on in our agency world because we're just getting pounded by so many demands. Mm-hmm. That's something that, both of us in retirement are very lucky to be able to focus on. We're able to focus on stories a little bit more on the Thin Green Line, on Warden's Watch, and dive into stuff that agencies can't necessarily dive into. Media structuring or however media releases are going for the proximity of the moment. And this is a really, this intrigues me. And it intrigues me from the standpoint because we're so passionate about, keeping people safe first and foremost. I mean, as game wardens, our thing is environment, protect our wildlife, waterways, and wild lands. But ultimately, we're law enforcement guys first, and public safety is paramountly the most important thing. And when you talk about public safety in the great outdoors, things get Western and more dangerous a lot quicker, obviously, because of the environment we work in. So you sent me a link. What are you guys doing these days to kind of bring our listeners and viewers up to date on some of the cases you're working on, just so they're familiar with the issue? And we'll take a Northwest case and, maybe this will spur some East Coast cases that are going to pop up and that people are going to be concerned about and that we can certainly elaborate on more with teams out here on the East side. But let us know what's going down.
All right. Well, right now, we just closed out the Rachel Lackaduck case. She went missing. She's 28-year-old woman. Went to the Hidden Lake Lookout in 2019. It was her birthday, October 17th. It was the first really bad winter storm of the season up here. So those end of October storms are the first really brutal ones.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
And she ended up getting caught up about 5,500 feet in the open. First bad winter storm was coming in. We were actually just coming down from a search for another missing lady who went missing the year prior down on Vesper Peak. We were just coming down from that. You know, we find out through the grapevine that, you know, there's a gal up there missing. Search and rescue is actively up there. Super bad conditions, avalanche danger, complete whiteout conditions. But they believed that she made it to the lookout. And if she would have made it to the lookout, they got supplies in there. They believe that she would have survived. And I've been trapped in a lookout up here for 7 days before. Got caught in a winter storm, and you're just stuck until it clears, and then you could get out. So they really believed and hoped that she got to the lookout, but they couldn't get anybody up because the way that where the this lookout's situated is really dangerous in winter conditions. Finally, after 6 or 7 days, they finally were able to drop a guy in by the helicopter to the lookout. She wasn't there. No evidence that she was that she made it there.
Right.
And then they started scouring the mountain for her, but didn't turn up anything. You know, we heard about it, and we went up. Me and my team went up and started looking, and ended up meeting the husband, Jamie, coming down off of a search. We were up there for 3 days and came down because of conditions, and met him coming up to post missing person flyers on the trailhead sign. Talked to him, you know, told him what we were up there doing. Hey, I want to, you know, coordinate with you guys. Search and rescue called off the search, and I can't leave my wife up here alone. Met her father, Brad, dad, and pretty much just started. They made me their family search operations manager and said, hey, you know, lead the team, do whatever, bring our girl home, please. We have nobody else to turn to.
Yeah.
So for the last 2 years, myself personally, I put over 500 hours on the mountain. I got over 100 miles. This is where I kind of differ with search and rescue. You know, search and rescue, they have to add all their hours from the moment they leave their house to the moment they return to their house. All those hours are counted. Their miles of how many miles they travel is from when they leave their house to when they return. Me, I don't want to disparage that. I know the reasons why they have to do that, but I think it gives the families a false sense of the amount of effort that's going into these searches. You know, in Rachel's case, it was, oh, we spent 8,000 hours searching, and the families sit there and they think that, wow, you know, if you spent 8,000 hours searching in 7 days, you had an army of hundreds out there. You know, they really don't understand that. Whereas with me, when I say I got 500 hours, that's 500 hours in the search zone searching, 100 miles of actually off the trail searching in the search zone. And that way they have a true, clear grasp of what we're putting into it. And that's just me personally. That's not counting the other dozen or people that are in my team, and even more. Sometimes we have up to 20 people out there at a time too.
Well, and just to jump in for a second on that,
yeah.
To that point, when you get to the point where that person is missing that long, they're not going to be in conventional areas where, you know, we're going to go on a first sweep or a secondary sweep. You're usually they're off the grid, completely different, in a different location than they were suspected to be. I'm thinking about cases specifically like Yosemite Park and the Eastern Sierra up there about around Mount Whitney on some stuff we worked. And, you know, these people weren't anywhere where they were supposed to be because they, you know, put a wrong location down. They were unfamiliar with the area. Something really heinous happened completely out of the area. So, and a search and rescue team from agency can't be expected to figure that out obviously, because we're going to a specific area based on an itinerary and we're working the best we can with what we have and bringing the resources we can. And yeah, they cost a lot. It costs a lot to transport us up there and to divert from other jobs and to bring in people on all those, you know, quote unquote, they are bureaucratic, but necessary overtime budgets, operational budgets, logistics planning, all the stuff we do. You guys can go in a lot freer and you can go in a lot longer. And you're not, you know, and you're not on basically a limited supply chain. You're supplying your own funds or getting funds from, I'm guessing, NGO volunteer funds or donations or whatever the case might be, and probably working out of pocket, I would imagine, quite a bit as well.
Yeah, a lot of it is out of my pocket. I'm a carpenter by trade. I'm a journeyman carpenter. So a lot of it is, you know, I, especially since the Sam Sayers case is when I really got thrown into it. That was the missing gal who went, she went missing in Vesper Peak in 2018, out on a day hike, real popular trail, vanished without a trace. You know, me and my friends were like, hey, let's go lend a hand, went up there, searched, ended up running into her father, soon to be father-in-law, and her father on the trail. And, you know, it's always a brush by shoulders. Oh, what do you guys, you know, we got a missing family member out here. Yeah, we're out here looking, you know, and they really are just like taking like, oh, wow, surprise. Like, wow, these crazy mountain guys are out here looking for my loved one. You know, they're kind of blown away by it. And then so in that one, the Sam Sayers case, it's the longest search and rescue operation in the history of Washington State. It was 27 days, over 10,000 hours spent, numerous resources from all over the country was involved in that case. You know, we ended up meeting, like I said, her father and her soon-to-be father-in-law, her fiance's dad, Kevin Darius, who is a chief warrant officer in the U.S. Army down in Louisiana. And, you know, we ended up coordinating with Sam's boyfriend or fiance, however you want to call it, Kevin Darius Jr. We ended up meeting up with him on the mountain and started to coordinate. And I actually just started a job, a new job at the time as a foreman for this one company. And they called the John Francis Foundation. I don't know if you've heard of that foundation, the John Francis Foundation. He's based out of, I think he's based out of Idaho or Montana. David Francis runs it, the father of John. He went missing in the Sawtooth Mountains quite a few years ago. You know, SAR search for a week ended, and David hired just ground pounder, outdoor guides and hunters to go out and search, and found his son. I think it was like 2 years after the fact, a year or two after he went missing. Wow. And then started the foundation called the John Francis Foundation. And what they do is they assist families, kind of like what we do. They're more administrative, helping families, you know, giving them the resources, hooking them up with, you know, search operations plans and helping them manage a family search for the for a loved one. So the Darius family contacted them and they came out. And this was one of the things that, you know, was kind of disparaging was, you know, David Francis is well known in the search and rescue community and helping families with missing loved ones. And he wanted to meet with, you know, the county SAR manager to be able to find out, you know, what they did, what resources, where they searched. And the county manager was like, I'm not meeting with that guy at all. And, you know, David asked Kevin, you know, well, who's the, you know, who else do you know that would talk to me that knows the mountain as good as, you know, the SAR manager? And he was like, Bud Carr. So they paid to have me flown up onto the mountain to meet with David Francis. Met with David Francis. He brought in an HRD canine and handler at that time too. Did a day search with an HRD canine. Went back to Kevin's house to have a meeting. This was probably the beginning of October, September-ish, end of September, beginning of October. And, you know, the family asked David, hey, you know, what do you think a good plan to do? And he, you know, and he's like, well, look, he said, the season, we only got about a month left before the snows come in and the season knocks us off the mountain. Your best bet is to make Bud Carr your search operations manager, since he knows so much about this mountain and has pretty good search and, you know, search and rescue experience and mountain man experience, make him your operations manager if he'll take it on, and let him go with it. Because by the time we get, you know, coordinated and deployed, we'd be getting kicked off the mountain.
Right.
You know, so the family straight up looked at me like, hey, you're our only hope. And I was like, well, I got to call my company. And I called my boss of the company. I was like, hey, man, I was like, I gotta quit. This family needs me. I, you know, if you want me when it's done, I'll come back and be your foreman. But right now, God is telling me that I got to help these people because they have nobody else to turn to. And my company was like, hey, it's really respectable. You know, if a position's here for you when you get back, you're more than welcome to come back.
Cool support there. So what was the outcome of that? How did it all go?
She's still missing.
Okay.
She is still missing.
But you guys did a good push.
Yeah. You know, and we still go up there occasionally. Just this last weekend, Kevin and a couple people from the team were up there looking in a couple specific spots. There's not very many spots left. The number one spot where we think she might be is underneath a snow moat off the north face, which is under a glacier. And that's just too dangerous. You can't go up underneath a glacier in those, you know, snow moats to search. And we don't have really the technology yet to do that. So either we got to wait for technology to clear that area, or until global warming finally melts off all the glaciers, and we can, whichever one comes first. So as of now, you know, we only have one true win, if you want to call it that, and that was the discovery of Rachel Lackaduck, which was August 14th. We finally found her.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that, Bud? The locating her. Can you talk about wrapping up that case and the location? You know, I'm assuming your team located her.
Yeah. We were the team who found her. And it all stemmed from a discovery of her father's last year at the last search before the weather pushed us off the mountain last year. Her father and a couple of the guys, because, you know, we encourage, if the family's physically able to go out, we encourage them to go out because it gives them solace to be out there looking.
Mm-hmm.
So Brad Dad came over, and him and some of his friends from Eastern Washington, they're from Spokane, Moses Lake area on the eastern side. And, you know, I have my little search zones depending on, you know, the teams. And I put the family and, you know, the lesser experienced people in the easier, safer terrain. And us, you know, more experienced guys will take on the more sketchy stuff. And he ended up finding a campfire. And we find all sorts of stuff. I mean, we find more trash that human beings leave behind than we find human beings, unfortunately. So we're always cleaning it up there. And balloons, man, I hate fucking balloons. I don't know how many freaking balloons. I'm sure John has found probably way more than me after 28 years out there in the woods.
There's, you know, that's a funny side tangent, but there were more Mylar balloons on the West Coast, Silicon Valley, just floating, I think, from between Canada and Mexico. I can be on my most pristine backcountry, you know, foothills in the Central Coast and be 50 miles back in and find 5 Mylar balloons just laying out in Blacktail Trophy, Blacktail Country, and go, how do they get here?
You know, right.
The ranchers with us on it. All the private landowners that are outdoorsmen are like, oh, here's another balloon. Woohoo.
Yeah. Happy birthday balloons are the ones I always find. And I was like, we have a little inside joke. It's like the only time a happy birthday balloon is not going to piss me off is when it's actually my birthday and I find it out there searching.
Yeah, it's a kind of a funny little side story, guys, but a really good private rancher friend of mine that I still spend a lot of time with when I'm in the Golden State, either hunting on his land or just going over security issues related to, you know, illegal cannabis or water diversions or whatever. He just had his 50th birthday and he posted a social media post that said, hey, everyone, thanks for all the great birthday wishes, but you can stop sending me balloons. And he put, there's a picture of a Mylar balloon. He found it like an 0 and a 5 from different places on his ranch.
Too
funny. He's like, no more balloons, please. I'm done with that. I comment personally, but hey, kudos to you guys for cleaning that up. You're making a dent, right? So you're up there doing environmental cleanup. So there's always a positive spin. It never hurts to be out there. Even if you're coming up with 0, 0, 0, you're always making a dent. What's this case? You sent us a link.
Yeah. Can we finish that other case though? Because we still have it.
Yeah. I think. Yeah. Yeah. Wait.
We're almost there.
all right. So Brad Dad found this fire. At the time when he found it, we have a lot of snowboarders, alpinists, skiers that, and just hikers that use this area. It's a really popular spot. There was nothing definitive that said, oh, this could have been, Rachel was here. But over the whole winter, something was just eating at him. Something was just telling, and he kept referencing the tidiness. He's like, the tidiness of the trash just speaks to me that it's my daughter. My daughter was here. Rachel was. Who knows their child better than a father? You know, what minute detail would speak more to anybody than a father? Nobody. A father knows his child best. Now husbands might know a child more intimate, but a father knows his child best. And something just kept eating at him about this fire. And the husband, Jamie, and Brad Dad, as we call him, they were kind of at opposing forces because, we found a cup of noodle, some hand warmers, and a whole bunch of glow sticks. And so the hand warmers and the glow sticks, is things that her and her husband would use, but they would never eat cup of noodles when they'd go out in the mountains. Right. But that was always because it was him and her. They had always used Mountain House. So the husband, Jamie, was like, I really don't feel that's Rachel's because she wouldn't eat cup of noodles. But Brad Dad was like, no, the tidiness, the tidiness of all the trash and the way it was left there. He's like, this screams Rachel. So this year, we were getting ready to go and boot up for the first part of our search mission, which was around Memorial Day. But another person went missing, Tom Simonseth, on the mountain at that time at the end of May, the day after my birthday. He went missing in the same area. Their PLS was like less than 100 meters apart. Wow. So the family reached out to us to go up there since they knew, there ain't nobody that knows that mountain better than Bud Carr and his team. After 2 years of searching for Rachel up there, he knows that mountain. So they reached out to us and, so we went and started working there. But since they're in the same area, we're kind of working the cases at the same time. Mm. Finally, Tom's best friend finds him when we came off the mountain from a search that very next day. He found Tom. So we were actually going back to search for Rachel. But while, over the wintertime, Brad Dad just kept saying, hey, something about this just says Rachel. Okay. So we found another spot on a search earlier this year that, had Mountain House, looked like someone took shelter, looked like it was a couple years old. So, I told Brad Dad, I was like, I want to get you down to this spot and I want to, see what you feel.
Get your
from
vibe,
this
yeah.
new spot
yep.
from the old spot. I just want to get, and it almost killed him, unfortunately. I mean, I had to carry his backpack out. He was having, he was the most brutal trip that he's ever been on in his life. And we got him down there and, he sat down, tried to, center himself. And he was like, yeah, this is just trash.
Yeah.
Nothing speaks to me at all. So we got him back to the forward operating base. And I was like, okay, well, we're going to go from this point, the fire that you believe is Rachel's, we're going to get to there and we're just going to let the terrain dictate us down the mountain as that she's just bombing straight down the western flank of the mountain and see what happens. We did that. Me and two other guys did that in the end of July. I came within about 40 feet of her remains in the end of July. And then we were going back up in August to do another search, but they closed the trailhead and the road because of the Pincer Creek fire.
Right.
And the night before we were getting ready to go out for the weekend, Brad Dad calls me and he's like, hey, I heard that the road's closed and the trailhead's closed. And I had the writer and outdoor photojournalist from the Spokane Review already planned to come out that weekend, they were wanting to do a story on us. And they figured that it would be, a few months of, you know, coming out with us in the woods doing this story.
Hey, Bud, right? Can I interrupt you just for a minute? John, are you hearing that feedback at all? The click, 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 click,
I'm
click,
hearing
click.
A lot of crackling.
Yeah, it was getting bad, so I don't know.
It could be my voice because I'm getting.
No, it's electronic sound, so.
It's like a cracking in your microphone.
So I don't know if we should bring you out. Try it again there, Bud. It was just getting to the point where it was. I don't know if Jay can clean that up.
Is it better at all? Or
I still got it. Do you, John?
Still some cracking, yeah.
Yeah.
But we're on the edge of our seats, man.
I know, and that's why I was. I mean, I could cut this stuff out too, but don't get me.
We're going to finish because this is getting close to Rachel, man.
So, and hopefully our good producer can take out the crackling. So, I didn't want to, but if we could have fixed it, I wanted to try to fix it.
Yeah, good call, Wayne.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know, Brad Dad calls me Thursday night. We're headed out Friday morning. Going to stay out till, you know, Sunday evening. And, you know, we already have a forward operating base up at 5,500 feet up on the mountain. We already got gear, food, supplies stashed up there in buckets and stuff. So that, you know, that's where we operate from. And Brad Dad calls. He says the road's closed. I check with the Forest Service. Yeah, road is closed. And, you know, Brad Dad's like, so are we going to call off the search? And I was like, no. You know, I got people already planned to come. You know, the outdoor writer and the photojournalist is planning on coming, you know, no, I was like, nothing's going to stop us. So, you know, I told Brad Dad, I said, look, I was like, this could be the roadblock. This could be the roadblock that diverts us right where we want to go. You know, yeah, since we can't, you know, search from above to below where we wanted to be, I was like, we're just gonna have to start from the road and go straight up the mountain. And so Friday we get there in the morning, we go out for a recon. Half the team showed up Friday. We go out for a recon, go up to about 3,500 feet. We had to start at like 1,100 feet off the main road. And we're going up 45 degree, you know, Pacific Northwest bush. It's hell, all that duff. You know, you might as well be on ice with all that duff and those pine needles underneath that old growth. Saturday morning, you know, Friday night, everybody shows up. The outdoor reporter and the photojournalist show up Friday night. You know, we set up for preparing the search in the morning. My plan was to get up to the 4,500 foot level because it's just there's a terrain feature there where it's really nice and shallow and then becomes pretty steep from the south or the north. And it kind of funnels you into this drainage. And I knew that the terrain would, if she was going down that terrain, it's going to funnel her right into this drainage that we were actually camped on at the bottom by the road. And, you know, we split up into different teams. I like to run, you know, if we got 6 to 10 guys, I'll have, you know, two guys paired up or gals. We got women out there who help too. We just go out in two-man teams, couple hundred meters apart or wherever we can keep eyesight on each other and start bombing up the mountain. You know, I ended up finding first a piece of vertebrae. You know, you never expect it. And, you know, since I want to throw this in here real quick. You know, morale, you guys can attest to this. Morale is a huge thing about being out there in the wilderness, especially when you're doing work like this. You have to keep your morale up. And I have guys and I've had people who come out, you know, and they expect, today's the day we're going to find her. Today's the day we're going to find her. And then we don't find anything. And they're so demoralized that they don't want to come back. Me, in my mind, for my personal well-being, you know, I go out there knowing or trying to put in my head that I'm not going to find her today. All I'm doing is clearing ground of where that person is not at. And that's how I keep my morale up, because I never go out thinking today's the day we're going to find her. Me and another guy that was with me, we find a piece of vertebrae. You know, it's really odd. It doesn't look like deer. You know, it's kind of smallish, but it just don't really look like a human vertebrae. But then again, I'm not that great with human bones. So we put it in a bag, you know, continue on. And I usually call out at certain intervals of, you know, where people are at. See what elevation they're at, and then usually have, you know, a break, take a 10-minute break every hour, because it's brutal terrain. You don't want to wear yourself out.
So I call for everybody to stop where they're at, have a break, you know, consolidate together, break together, and then we'll fan back out after break and keep moving. And at break, one of the guys, Kevin, who is the fiance of the missing girl, Sam, he was kind of got a little away from the group and the team. So he's like, okay, I'm going to lay down and take a nap. He lays down and takes a little, you know, 5-10 minute cat nap. Well, all the rest of us are consolidated together, and he's about 4,500 feet. And, you know, break's over. I call over the radio. Okay, break's over. Everybody try to, you know, get eyes on each other that if you're away from the group. Kevin goes up and stands on this boulder, looks over, and there's Rachel right there, 10 feet from where he was laying down.
Mm. Wow. What did you guys ascertain? I mean, after all that time, finally finding her, did it look like there was a survival camp there going? Was she kind of trying to hold on?
She totally did. And that was, you know, I went twice since last year and this year. I came within 40 feet of her remains and didn't see her. She found this real low hollow next to this giant hemlock windfall that fell across. You know, there's a big boulder on one side. There's this huge hemlock on the uphill. She found this little low depression because it was super, you know, we had 55 mile an hour winds that night. Yeah. So it was super windy, snowy. You know, she put her, you know, hypothermia is what got her being wet because she didn't have any rain gear, none of her gear. She didn't have a tarp, nothing, you know, but she did try to do everything right. She put her sleeping pad down, tucked next to this tree as much as possible, got inside her sleeping bag, you know, stuck her hiking poles up, and then tried to prop her backpack and other things above her to try to shed water.
Yeah.
And took off her boots, got inside there, hunkered down, went to sleep, and woke up somewhere else.
Wow. Wow. And remind us, how long had it been since she was reported missing or last seen?
She was last seen October 17th of 2019, and we found her August 14th of 2021. So just under 2 years.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Yeah. Well, great find regardless, man. And I'm sure as hard as it was to see that, I can imagine that, there was a lot of relief on the family's part with all the effort, and they were embedded in the search with you, you know?
Yeah.
And again, I think this just adjuncts what we do on the formal search and rescue medium of having guys and gals on teams like yours doing this. And it's critical. Wow. Well, great work on that one, man. That was and you know, to your point, you mentioned the morale being the biggest thing in staying motivated. Like, we're going to find her today. We're going to find her today. We're going to find her today. It's like any long-term investigation Wayne and I are involved in, and I can talk about some Met missions that went years, you know. My saying is always, hey guys, it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's a long, arduous race that a very small percentage of a population are ever going to finish, you know, because you're not going to find everybody, obviously. I mean, you're looking for a needle in a stack of needles in these environments.
Yeah.
West Coast, doesn't matter where you're at, man. I mean, we all live in some crazy backcountry bush. So it's a major victory when you find somebody. Mm-hmm. But I think as long as you're trying, it's still a positive. And
yeah.
Set your expectation level appropriate and look at it as, you know, kind of NFL chunk plays, right? We may not find her, but we might. So today we're going to cover this much. And that's the first part of a relay race. Then we're going to take the next half of the relay race, and we're just going to keep it a marathon, and we're just going to keep crawling. We're not going to run, not going to burn out. We're just going to keep mentally relatable to what the situation requires. And I think that you said that really well. And I never really had never articulated that on this type of mission. So well said. And for people that want to join a team like yours, perhaps more people will, maybe when listening to this up in the area you and I are at, maybe what, you know, we'll get some interest on the East Coast if there are teams like this or other parts of the country, but at least we can put it out there. And we can also prep people for the right mindset to be successful on a team like this going into it. And I think you said it well.
Yeah.
And Thank you.
I think you deploy a lot of East Coast methods in your tactics, but I mean, doing drainages, things like that, that's stuff we do. We embed the family with search and rescue missions just so they know what the terrain is like, how it's like, what the search and rescue mission. That's priceless, we've found through the years of working with family. If there's members that want to, we send them out with a good team of game wardens so they don't get hurt, so they can participate, and they're vital to that. And the second thing is they know what's happening with the volunteer search and rescue teams as well as the state search and rescue teams. Do you have a vetting process for members and stuff like that, or so you're not putting out people?
We look for people who are, you know, mountaineers, alpinists. Not just, you know, we do get a lot of people who are like trail runners and hikers. You know, we're like, oh, I'm a very experienced hiker. And it's like, well, yeah, you're a great hiker on the trail, but we're not hiking trails. Right. You know, we're going into the side hill. We're going into the hell hole.
Yeah.
We want guys who, and gals who can be in the hell hole and not have to worry about injury.
Absolutely.
At all. So, you know, our vetting is, you know, I look at it like, you know, I was raised in the Colorado Rockies in the 80s when my dad had the gold mine. I was 7 years old. They'd be gold mining, and my dad be like, take your dog and run around the mountains. You know, and I'm running around up at 11,000 feet above Granite, Colorado, with grizzly bears and mountain lions running around me. And then the Uinta Mountains of Utah, and now the Cascades of Washington State, because I've been here since the 90s. That speaks more to me than diploma on the wall, is the guys who have just, you know, like myself, I live in these mountains. I drive 20 minutes and I'm at 5,000 feet. And this is my backyard. Mm-hmm. So we look for those type of people. You know, we do like the rough around the edges, cuss too much, you know, mountain men, hunters, the guys who aren't doing the Instagram selfies of, oh, I just summited Mount Hood, look how cool I am. I want the guy who went to the peak and summited the peak that nobody likes because it's the ugliest mountain. And, you know, and there's no good photo backdrop. That's the guy I want.
Yeah.
You know, it's, we call it a PhD from the School of Hard Knocks, you know?
Exactly.
And to your point, you mentioned hunters in that whole lineage of the right types for this. And you're right. I call it real hunters. I call it the bow hunters, the way we hunt here in Montana. You know, you're not on roads. You're not road hunting. You're doing a lot of footwork scouting before season, during season, after season, knowing your mountain. And when you get to know so much about the demographics of where your animals and the temperate zones and whitetail trails and all those things, you get to know things in the woods that you don't normally see on a recreational hike off a trail, right? When you have that type of experience, and the places you're going to look for a water hole, for a bedding area, is kind of a place where a stranded hiker or a lost hiker, somebody in the snow, they're going to hole up in a good bedding area where the animals do, or they're going to hole up near water, you know, if they can find it off a trail. And so absolutely, I mean, kudos to everybody that's a true hunter and a conservationist out there as a potential candidate. And it makes me think of the hunters that find these lost hiker remains. We get a lot of those on the West Coast. Some of my best reports, you know, they're finding cannabis grows from the cartels in the middle of nowhere that fortunately, you know, didn't end deadly because so many people couldn't get to this remote area and, you know, kept the public safety factor, couldn't find it. Same thing with these different hunting holes, you know, and they find a lot of missing persons or clues to the area where a missing person might be, last known trash pile, whatever. So yeah, it's it takes a certain grizzle, you know, little bit of hard character,
a
little
beast. Grizzle. You can say it takes a mountain beast, whether it's two-legged or four-legged.
Yeah, it really does, man. Real pipe hitters, guys and gals that really want to grind and get after it. But there are those out there. There's a lot more than people think that, and they love to help, man. What a way to put those skills and that, you know, that drive to work for the good, for the better good.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
No doubt. Great.
So what's this case coming up? Let's close out on what you guys are doing next, how people can reach you. And we can talk a little more about the foundation that does fund some of your efforts that could possibly fund other parts of the country that people may not be aware of.
Well, right now, we have quite a few cases right now of families who've reached out to us. The first one, which we're working on right now, is the Shirley Bauman case. She went missing last year near North Bend, Washington, about 3 hours away. They found her camp completely set up, but her and just a few small belongings were missing. You know, we still go down and search the Vesper area for Samantha Sayers. If there's any new leads or any time the son, Alan, wants to go up and search Stock Mountain, we'll go up there and search for Patty. We have a guy missing up near Yakutat. Their family reached out to us, a pilot. I can't remember his name. Alan something off the top of my head. He went missing just like 15 minutes out of Yakutat. They've reached out to us. If that's something that's going to be a year out, because it takes a lot of planning to be up there, and the winter and the conditions to flying up there is almost completely over with now. So there's quite a few. We've also been reached out by the Native American tribes.
Nice.
For the missing and murdered Indigenous women. They have reached out to us, wanting to coordinate, wanting to, get our help on some of their cases on reservations. The gal, Shelly, who I've been speaking to, who runs this, quick reaction force that she's putting together right now. The one thing that she really loves about me is the fact that I'll take a father or a loved one's gut instinct on something and run with it, whereas most agencies won't consider it because it's not in the book. So that's one thing that got her really hyped on us, is that I'm willing to just go off a gut feeling, because what else do you got to lose at this point?
Right.
So those are the main cases right now that we're kind of, looking at, helping out. We're actually going out this weekend. Got to go out a good team, about 12 really good, experienced men and women, that's going to be going down this weekend to go search for Shirley. And, hopefully we can bring some resolve there this weekend. It would be nice to get another person home before the winter really sets in and keeps us out of the mountains.
Yeah. And Godspeed and good luck on that. That's something we'd like to stay in touch with you on, and certainly whatever we can do to help, but keep us posted on how those things go. We'll certainly keep in touch. We're connected now, and just really impressed with what you guys are doing. You know, it's such a,
thanks.
It's a hard physical job to do, and it's a hard mental job to do, because of what you're going to find. It's a different kind of win. I'll just put it at that.
It is.
It's a different kind of win, but it's a hard win. It's a painful win, but it's so necessary. And kudos. We really appreciate your efforts out there.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. Brad, Dad, that's another thing that I really, have learned in, being involved in these cases is the bonds with these families. Yeah. The other night, at 11:30 at night, Brad, Dad calls me up. Having a really bad time, dealing with the fact that he'll never touch his beautiful daughter again. Ugh. It's 11:30 at night, he's drunk, really in all such a bad sorts. And I talked to him for 3 hours on the phone, standing on my front porch while the family was asleep, just talking him down, talking him out of a bad headspace. And that's the greatest reward. There's a lot of people, we get a lot of this, oh, these families pay these guys to do this, it's morally wrong and all this stuff. And, they do help out with, food and supplies, and they buy us dinners after a good hard search. Me and my team, they're like, hey, let's take you to the restaurant and let's have you a good dinner, 'cause you just spent a week on the mountain eating shit food. but the greatest reward is that, is knowing that what you've done for these people means so much to them that they call you in the middle of the night, you know, and want to talk to you because you formed that bond with them that no amount of money will ever, you know, be able to bridge that gap with somebody. And that's the greatest thing to take away from all of this is that, yeah, we are bringing families home. We are bringing, you know, closure to them, but we're also growing the family too. You know, they consider me part of the family, just as I consider them part of my family now. And, you know, and that's the legacy to take away from this is even, you know, even in death, these people are still doing work on this earth, because if they weren't, why would we all come together and forge the bonds that we forged if these people still weren't doing God's work on this earth, even after they left it?
Yeah, that's really well said. And you got to remember, this isn't your day job, you know?
No.
You guys are doing this on your own time, on your own dime, after making a living for your families. So there's no more genuineness in that. And those bonds are beautiful when they're made, and they should be made, because the families know you guys are really in it for the right reasons. You're in it for them. You're not in it for you, other than the personal rewards you get from, you know, maybe getting some closure, but you're really showing empathy and love for those families and empathizing with the pain of that loss. And that's, you know, you just don't see that enough, and it's awesome. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, bud.
Thank you. Thank you guys.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being a guest with us. We really appreciate it and sharing what you guys are doing. So that's really cool. So,
yeah. And thank you guys for having me on, and thank you for all your services. I've been doing a deep dive into John and watching all the stuff that he's done. And I'm just so blown away and honored that, you know, that he's agreed to have me on. And also I'm probably going to be doing a deep dive into you, Wayne. And seeing what you're into and what you've done. Cause, you know, and I think that's, I think we're kind of at that point right now, in society, you know, in the outdoors is, you know, more guys like us who have, you know, got 20, 30 years in the backcountry, come together and, you know, education. I think education is going to be the biggest thing with keeping people safe out there. Not only from, you know, a law enforcement point of view, search and rescue point of view, but also, you know, from just regular common citizens like me and my team's point of view. You know, we got a lot of military guys. I have some active search and rescue people who come out, you know, because in up here in the West Coast, if you're part of a team, you can't go out on your own and search. You could lose your position on the team for that. I don't know why it's like that up here, but they really look down on that. So I got some search and rescue people who come in completely clandestine. We can't give them any props in the media, because if they do, they could get booted from their team. But I think that's the biggest thing is, you know, is educating people from all these different points of view, you know, points of view, law enforcement, search and rescue, and just like us crazy mountain men, to be able to keep people safe out there. Cause what a lot of people don't realize, you know, is the wilderness is still a wilderness. Wild is in it. It is a wild place. There's wild beasts and there's wild people out there. And we are part of that. You know, I believe in leave no trace, but at the same time, I don't believe in completely having no sign that a human traveled through, because we are, as human beings, we are part of the wilderness. You know, that is our home. That's where we have lived and died for thousands of years. It was wild. It's only been in the last, you know, 1,000 years where we've turned parts of the wilderness into civilization. But we are just as much a part of the wilderness as all the beasts who live out there 24/7. And I think a lot of people have forgot that, because we're separated from, oh, this is a wild place I just go and recreate at. It's like, no, you know, the urban environment is a wilderness also. It's just made out of steel and glass and concrete.
That's different animals.
Yeah. It's a different animal.
Yeah. And we're going to continue, you know, the whole thing Wayne and I do with this podcast, it's about spreading the message. That's the bottom line. It's about sharing things that everybody in the country and beyond are passionate about, whether they know it or not.
Right.
Public safety. And, you know, they don't call it the wilderness with wild in it for nothing. You said it. And I think respecting Mother Nature at the highest level and going in as prepared as you can and going in with a little technology like an InReach, you know, that I was old school until last year, never carried one. And finally my family up here in Montana said, dude, you're out there alone in what's the wildest of the lower 48 now. Glacier Lake, grizzly and bear, you know, all of it. And said, yeah, I guess it's time. And you know what? I was not being responsible. I wasn't being responsible to my family and to my profession. And I just don't think I was, you know, I was taking it for granted that I could deal with anything out there from the 20, 30 plus years experience that Wayne and I both have collectively and you have. And, you know, and when you start getting that confident and don't think about it, that's when things go sideways. So with these podcasts, we really share all the issues that are out there, good and bad, for the sake of everybody. And the work you're doing is helping with that. So we'll keep doing that together, but keep us posted on that case.
Cool.
Might be a great follow-up story, you know, depending on how everything goes. And thanks again for being on, and we'll be in touch.
Great.
All right. Thank you, John, for sure.
Thanks, bud.
Stay safe up there.
I will. You too, guys.
Spend your Saturdays with Life on the Water. Join Captain Brandon Simmons for fishing, diving, travel, and so much more.
You want to succeed. You want to fish. You want to be one of the greatest.
Oh, look at that thing, dude. Wow. Oh. Let's see what kind of trouble we can get into today.
Don't miss Life on the Water every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. The destination for outdoor entertainment. A life that has the stories to back it. A life to be proud of. It's a Winchester life.
Yeah, baby. 6'8 Western. Oh, mule deer, baby, right there.
Tune in every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.